In some place early in my life, I was bitten by a travel bug. It's sort of a fatal disease. It can get to you. I guess our concern, one of our main concerns at the village, is this idea of some global perspective, of seeing not just ourselves in our own community and our own situation, but having a feel for, hey, we're citizens of the world, and seeing ourselves as part of the global family. I do believe that international travel can do that for us if we let it. Now, there are a lot of people who travel and always try to compare how the bathrooms are over there compared to our plumbing. I mean, that's one of the first critiques you hear. Or people who will head for the Golden Arches or something and look for the fast food rather than the local food and so on. I think travel may help if we also try to learn something about the people. And I would like to share just a few experiences in the way of vignettes of people I've met. It happens to be women that we're focusing on, but it could be men just as well. And I would invite you to think about people you have met, either elsewhere in the world in your travels, for many of you are well-traveled, or in your own community, people who are different from yourselves and from whom you've learned something. Because I think we must always go to learn from others if we're going to have global understanding and not judge them just by ourselves. I suppose my first real experience in international travel, other than going across the border to Mexico, was about a dozen years ago when I was a delegate of the American Lutheran Church Women to the Bastad Consultation on Women, sponsored by the Lutheran World Federation. And that was really my first real global experience, where there were only six of us from North America, and the other women, and a few men, and the other women were from all over the world, particularly where there are Lutheran churches, but they were not all Lutheran. And so I'd like to start with that little experience and then give you a few stories of individuals I met there and in other places, and ask you to think about what you have learned from other people. So this is sort of woman to woman, different people from different parts of the world. At the Bostad consultation, Bostad is in Sweden, we had women from many, many different areas. In this case, there's a woman from Argentina and a woman from Brazil. You would recognize that their features are European heritage, and so we recognize that in Latin America, particularly in Argentina, and in parts of Brazil and in some other countries, there are people very much like ourselves whose ancestors came from Europe. So that isn't too exciting, but more exciting were the women from other parts of the world that are a little bit more strange to us. Some of the consultants here from Taiwan and from Tanzania and so on. These happen to be Lutheran women also. And here again, a variety of people, participants. But rather than taking a general view, I'd like to focus particularly on some beautiful African women and one in particular. This was really my first for meeting African women directly. And I suppose after a week with these women, I decided that they had the most beautiful smiles in the world. And these were women who had come from places like Tanzania and other areas, and they were out of their countries for the first time. What made them seem a lot more human was when one of us admired the hairdo underneath the wraparound, and when she took it off, she had a very nice hairdo, and he said, "I like your hairstyle." She said, "Oh, that's a wig." And so that made her very much more human right to begin with, and a sister with whom we could have much conversation. But this is not women in general, but it's specific women. One woman who is very memorable, and this is not the best picture of her, was a young woman from South Africa named Brigalia. In fact, I know her last name, but I won't give it here. Brigalia was a young woman who had the equivalent of a master's degree, a very, very brilliant young woman who was serving in an ecumenical office in Geneva. She was not able to go back home. She was from South Africa, and at that time, and still, there is a policy of apartheid, where she had a very responsible leadership position in Geneva. But if she would go back to South Africa, she would have to be in a very subservient position and would not be able to exercise that kind of leadership. And so there I learned from Begalia what it must mean to never be able to go home. Pardon me. That's not emotion. It's my sore throat. So when you think about it, in terms of the status of women, to think that it's not only who you are, but that if you are, for example, black in the wrong country, you do not have any privileges or any rights. The next person I'd like to introduce you to in a different setting is in Moscow. I was a member of People to People Science Educators, and we were guests at Moscow State University. The more mature woman is named Galina. I can't pronounce her last name. She was head of the physics department of the University of Moscow, Moscow State University. Thank you. That's sweet. For one whole day, Intourist was kind enough to leave us alone without the Intourist guide. Galina had a second language. She did not speak English. She spoke Russian. She spoke German as her second language. I speak German as a second language. So Galina and I were able to converse much of a day, and I served as interpreter for her in my fractured German. When we could speak woman to woman, as teachers, as professors, we had so much in common. We agreed while walking arm in arm down the streets of Moscow that students are the important thing in teaching, and that the teacher must be concerned about the welfare of the students. Galina took me and a few of my friends to her favorite ice cream place on Nevsky Prospect. And we had many conversations. I recognized that she was not able to travel as freely as I was. She said she'd like to come visit in the United States. Oh, say, thank you. But we recognized that was not possible. We exchanged names and addresses. And in parting, she saw us off at the airport, and in parting, she wanted to leave something with me. She rummaged around in her purse, which is about as voluminous as most women's purses are here, like mine, and found in the bottom of her purse a little vial of French perfume, which she gave me. Well, Galina and I exchanged addresses, but I thought no more of it. That was in summer. Came Christmas time, and I had a greeting from Galina all the way from Moscow. Now, it was not a Christian Christmas card. It was a kind that the Russians put out to celebrate winter, Father Christmas kind of thing. So, of course, I answered, took a little practice and a little help writing in German, and she answered, and this went on for about 2 years. And I really felt great in having a friend in Moscow. Then a colleague of mine, a Texas Lutheran, was taking students to Russia one January interim. So I gave him Galina's address, and I also gave him a little gift for her. I thought an appropriate non-threatening gift would be something very American, an Indian arrowhead from my father's collection, an artifact from Texas. And so my colleague asked the Intourist guide about getting in touch with Galina. The Intourist guide was very, very much upset, said, well, I'll see if we can arrange it. She took the Indian artifact, the message. He never heard anything. I never heard from Galina again. I was very bothered by that, but I will always remember Galina, because when I think about all those missiles which we have pointed at the Soviet Union, I think of my friend Galina and a few other women particularly that I could tell you about that I met person to person. Women in Russia who cannot be my enemies. I may disagree with their government, but those people are not my enemies. And if I forget, I look in the bottom of my purse, and here still with me at Holden Village is that tiny little vial of perfume from my friend Galina, the physics professor in Moscow State University. Now we're going to China, to the little village farm commune of Qingquangdao. As you see, the streets are not paved. There's no running water in the homes, so the women have to get their water there. And this is Mrs. Wang. Now, because one works only through an interpreter there, of course, I didn't get to know her as well as I did Galina, where we could speak a language that we both understood. Mrs. Wang is what you would call a leader of a team. And the teams, of course, are grouped into brigades, and the brigades into the commune. This is a commune where they raise primarily fruit. By the way, Wednesday night, I'm doing a presentation on China for those of you who will be here, so I won't get into this very much. Mrs. Wang's simple home in the commune has a dirt floor, but that dirt floor is hard-packed and neat and very, very clean. And I won't go into details about the kong, the bed here, and so on, but to say that although it has a dirt floor, there are pictures on the wall, some paintings that her daughter had done that are attractively done. I'm not doing too well on this. And a home that is very, very neat and clean. I think what I learned particularly from Mrs. Wang was her pride in serving her community. On the wall of her home are some certificates attesting her achievement as a brigade leader. Because in China, as a woman in China, she is geared not only to think about her family and the welfare of her family, but particularly the welfare of the country. This is in a region where before there was a lot of starvation. Now, we may not agree with the government's way of doing things in China, but most people who have gone there are saying that people are better off than they were before. And Mrs. Wang and her family are eating, and they're working cooperatively. I think from Mrs. Wang and others like her, I learned something about how one can work for community rather than for the individual family, where the welfare of the community is the important thing. And maybe we need to think about that a bit more. I'm having trouble focusing these because these are in focus. Mrs. Wang's kitchen is very, very simple. That's her stove, indoor stove, which also heats the bed, the outdoor stove, and the garden around there. She works very, very hard, 6 days a week, and she and her neighbors live very, very simply, but they are better off than their parent generation was. They're eating, and their concern for the community is something that must remain with a visitor to China, that concern for the welfare of the people as a whole. Skipping over to Japan, quite a contrast, of course, Tokyo downtown on a rainy day, we meet Keiko, a lovely young woman who was a guide and therefore spoke English very well. And I have to think of other young women and men in Japan who are living in a very technologically advanced society. The neon lights in downtown Tokyo, for those of you who have been there, make New York and Times Square look a little shabby. Tokyo is quite a bustling city. And yet, here is a generation that has only recently come into this new kind of lifestyle. There are a lot of people who are seeking their way, some of them perhaps still practicing the old religious ways, in this case, in a Buddhist temple. And I have to wonder about Keiko, because she's one of those many people caught in transition. You know that only much fewer than 1% of the people in Japan are Christian. How will this young woman, who is really in transition between a very traditional role for women in that culture, all of a sudden thrust into a technological society. I had to think of how is she handling this? The background is the old imperial palace, feudalism, but here is the new generation of the technological society. And we begin to realize that many, many women and men around the world are in times of transition where they must wonder what holds meaning in life and what will bring meaning to them. But let's go to Peru. In Peru, this is the fortress of Sacsayhuaman overlooking Cusco and Elizabeth. Elizabeth, again a guide, identified herself as a descendant of the Inca. These are Inca ruins which the Spanish conquistadors had tried to destroy, but because they were so massive and well-built, they couldn't quite pull it off, and yet they did pretty much destroy the civilization. Or did they? Because a lot of the people in Peru and Bolivia and even in Ecuador to some extent have an ancestry that is pure Indian, in this case pure Inca, and as they study more about their own history, a people who were conquered, completely overrun, some of them are beginning to take pride in what was there and to take pride in their own national origins. Elizabeth expressed some of this. And I guess I had to think of those people in our own country whose ancestors were here before we were, some of whom had some pretty good things going, maybe not as impressive as the Incas did, but who also were a conquered people. And maybe it helped me understand something about the resurgence of pride in the American Indian. You know, a lot of American Indians live in what is good Lutheran territory. And when they are saying, hey, our people did have some things that are worthwhile, do we look at them as just being uppity? Or do we recognize the need for every person to be proud of who he or she is? I think I learned this from Elizabeth, who, although her people were conquered, yet there is a new pride in being part of a group of people who had great achievements in the past. And now we're going to the little village of Pomaski, Ecuador. Small village, rather poor people. And here are Senor and Senora Espinosa. That's their real name. They are primarily Indian heritage also. They are rather poor. They are sandal makers. And they have a man's role and a woman's role. He makes the base of the sandals. She does the embroidery for the tops of the sandals. And they're able to make a pair of sandals a day by working pretty long hours. And then they have a son who works in Quito, takes a bus to Quito, works in one of the hotels, and he will take sandals in to be sold in the market there or in some of the nice gift shops. Their income by both husband and wife working together all day, they get $2 for a pair of sandals. So you could say the income for both of them, cash income, is $2 a day for two people working. I wish I had some more pictures of their house. The kitchen has, again, a dirt floor. It was full of guinea pigs running around. These are people who are not starving, but a guinea pig is a prolific animal if you've ever raised any guinea pigs. You have guinea pigs. And a guinea pig is good food for lower middle class and lower class poor people in Ecuador and some other countries in South America. But they also have a little garden, and they also have a pig or two and a few chickens, and that's a real luxury. So they're a little bit better off than a lot of the people. I guess what I learned from the Espinosas was a reminder of how most of the world's people live. They seem to be fairly content. They're not starving. They're doing subsistence with very little cash income. They can raise most of the vegetables and fruits and things that they want, and then they'll have their market, and they'll exchange with neighbors and so on. They're not starving. So that they seemed very fairly happy, friendly, not at all complaining. In the home was a grandmother, I don't know whether it was his mother or her mother, who was totally deaf, barefooted, smiling, picking flowers, and giving us flowers. Something about, again, the loving care of the family, that the old grandmother, who was no longer productive, was a welcome member of the family who could be happy and who could share happiness just by passing out flowers. And I have to think of Senora Espinosa and her husband as typifying just, I guess, millions of people who live that very, very simple life. Now, sort of a family picture. Some of you who know my son and his wife who were here in the village last week will recognize them there in the picture. But I want you really to meet Cecilia. Cecilia is to the left. Cecilia and Leonardo, the man in the yellow sweater, and the son there to the right who isn't too bright, live in Cuernavaca. Cuernavaca, of course, is a famous place for language study. Leonardo is a cobbler. Their little house on the street is not too far from the cathedral in Cuernavaca. And those of you who've been there might have walked by their house. The door from the street opens into his little shop where he makes cobbles, does his thing. It has a smell of leather and so on. But he doesn't make very much that way, so he does double duty at night as a waiter in a restaurant. Because of their convenient location and because of the fact that many students come to Cuernavaca for language study, they in the backyard of their little house, which is wall to wall with the next house, a little patio, a house which she inherited from her family, they built a little cement block room which they rent out to language students. Very, very simple room. So my son and his wife were, you might say, boarders with Leonardo and Cecilia for a number of months. And I came down there to visit them. Now, Leonardo and Cecilia they would be poor people by any standards in my community. Very, very simple facilities. I mean, the laundry's done outside and the patio and wash tubs and things like this. Very, very few conveniences. But they were some of the most kindest, most gracious people I have met. When I came to visit, I was the honored mother of the children whom they had called their own. In other words, they loved my son and his wife as their own children. Not seeing them simply as objects of bringing in a little extra cash, but really making them a part of the family. And I could feel that. I had been told that, but I could sense that. And it made me feel so good that a woman of another culture, another country, could adopt my own son and his wife as her own. They must know that we are richer than they, because there are plenty of tourists in Cuernavaca, and they know these students have to have the money to get there in the first place. But there was a quiet dignity about Cecilia and Leonardo. I was part of the family meal. They let me do the dishes. I'm good at dish teams. They let me do the dishes and so on, accepted me as one of the family. There was no apologies for what they didn't have. Have you ever had a guest who is a very special guest and you started apologizing, you know, the house just wasn't in order and you knew it wasn't as fancy as your guest was used to? Cecilia didn't do that. With her quiet dignity, knowing that I must have a little nicer house than she did, with her quiet dignity, she accepted me as one of the family. She made her favorite and my favorite chiles rellenos for me, especially, and accepted me as a friend. I learned a lot about gracious hospitality from Cecilia and from Leonardo in Cuernavaca. And then, one more little vignette. Let's go to Sogamoso, Colombia. In January of 1980, through Roy and Mary Seeger, who were in Holden Village the summer of 79 when I was here last, I learned that the Lutherans of Colombia were having their convention in January. And because I had other friends there who were working with Lutheran missions, Gerhard and Polly Cartford, whom some of you may know, I arranged my January interim personal development travels to include a visit several days with the Lutherans of Colombia in convention, of course, all in Spanish, good language practice. The convention was held in this town of Sogamoso, about 3 hours from Bogota. It's a town of about 40,000. I would say it's really an overgrown Indian village, and the streets aren't paved and so on. Those of you who saw my Latin America presentation last week saw this slide, which represents the cathedral in the background. And the foreground is a monument to La Raza, again, pride in the ancient heritage, in this case, Chibcha, an ancient civilization that was there and was conquered by the Spanish. All right, this is the setting, Sogamoso. The young people of the Lutheran Church in Colombia, with whom Roy and Mary Seeger worked, had a sort of a retreat not too far from Bogota. And some of them had spent a couple of days in the spacious parsonage, which the church had purchased just for this hospitality kind of thing. And then we all, about half a dozen Colombian young people, Pastor Seeger, Gerhard Cartford, and I, loaded into the mission van for about a 3-hour trip. Denise to the left, and Julia to the right, and I'll explain the man in the middle in a little while, were two of those teenagers. I have never anywhere seen a more beautiful and happier and more radiant group of young people than were those young Colombian Lutheran Christians. For 3 hours in the van, they sang some of the songs they had learned in the retreat, witnessing to their faith. For 3 solid hours, they kept it up, singing those songs. They're beautiful, vivacious, radiant young Christians. All right, the man in the middle is Pastor Wenches, who is or was the president of the Lutheran Church of Colombia. But I particularly wanted to tell you about Denise to the left. Denise's home is in Sogamoso, the city where this convention was held. She's had a very hard life. And Roy Seeger told me that a lot of the young people with whom he had worked had very, very difficult situations. Her mother is rather poor, is widowed, takes in sewing for a living. Denise has gone through the Lutheran school there, proved to be very bright, and was very fortunate in testing out very high, so that she was one of the minority of students accepted into the university in Bogota. You know, we take it for granted that almost anyone can go to college. And if you can't get into Yale or Harvard, you can always get in someplace else. But in Colombia, that's simply not true. So Denise, because of this special gifts of language, which is to be her major, and just a very, very bright young woman, Denise then will be going to the university, or was going to the university at that time. But I had to think about Denise as, again, person to person, because spending many, many hours with her. You know, there's no Lutheran student ministry, the big university. I had to wonder about Denise, this big university campus in the big city now. Will her radiant faith hold up in all this new world to which she's exposed, the big city, which she doesn't know that well? And I also had to think about her future in her church. Because let's face it, her church is still pretty much male-dominated. And a bright young woman like this isn't going to turn out to be a pastor in this generation unless things move a lot faster than my friends there predicted. Will her gifts be recognized by her church? Or will she be turned off? That particular church is being cut loose from most of its North American ties to do its own thing. And it is hoped that the leadership of the kind of people like Denise and Julia, who is younger, Julia was only 16, that this kind of leadership will lead the church in indigenous ways, in other words, in their own way and yet being true to the gospel. And so ever so often, I have to think of the radiant faith of this lovely young woman, Denise, lovely young sister in Christ. And I wonder how she's doing at the university. I wonder, is she hanging in there? And is she still true to her church? And maybe I have to say a little prayer for her now and then. Now, those are just a few vignettes. And it's very nice to be able to meet people around the world.
But you know, you don't have to travel around the world to have that kind of experience. For one thing, I think I've also grown and learned a good deal in person-to-person relationships with some of our international students at Texas Lutheran College. I have been blessed to get to know some of them quite well, to have them guests in my homes and so on. I correspond with some of them. And I have learned so much from them. And they have blessed me much more than I have blessed them. And so for those of you who are in college and university communities, if there are international students, there are great opportunities for learning from women and men from other parts of the world. Perhaps some of you have hosted international students. How many of you have hosted international students? In a group like at Holden, I know some of you have. And then one other thought. Even if there aren't many people from other countries living in your particular community, it may be true that in your community, as in mine, there are different cultures. Now, I know there are a lot of towns where people are mainly of one kind. And I know in the upper Midwest, there are a lot of people who are primarily, let's say, Scandinavian. I come from a diverse part of the country, and I think I'm grateful for that because it helps me to keep growing. I remember Dr. Al Rognes, whom so you may recognize Al's name, telling how he never met anybody who wasn't a Norwegian until he was 18 because of the community in which he grew up. And I said, Al, I never met a Norwegian until I was 18. And that's true because I come from a different heritage. So as we are thrown into communities where there are people different from ourselves, we have so much to gain by seeking to know them person to person. I know all about Krumkaka and Mangatak and Ufda. Boy, I've learned to say Ufda and just a lot of things like that, even from some of my colleagues of different heritage. But also in my community, there are many, many Hispanic people whom I must not see just en masse, but whom I must get to know individual to individual, person to person. Some of them may be poorer, some of them may be richer, but I am enriched by getting to know them as people. And so I would like to ask you to think about experiences that you have had, people to people, maybe guests you've had, and what you have learned from them. Because really all I wanted to do was share some experiences with you about what I've learned from other people, and maybe ask you, would you like to share?
Rudy and I had the privilege of being sponsors of the international group on California Lutheran College campus. And they were so much fun. We would have them to our home, and instead of us feeding them, they came with their international dishes and had a regular smorgasbord of food from all nations. And it seemed to make them feel even more welcome because they could do something for us too.
Anybody else? This is testimonial time. What you've learned from international students or others. I don't know how far this reaches. We'll try.
You got to yell loud.
Okay. We were very privileged a few years ago to have a girl from Peru stay with us for 6 months, and she was not a student. She'd come up to live with a stepsister, and it hadn't worked out, so she came and lived with us. Her name was Amparo Segura, and she worked in a sewing factory. And the interesting part of it is that we learned to really appreciate how privileged we are, because she would come into our house and we'd have, you know, lights on all over the place, and she would come in very quietly and turn everyone off until there was only one for the place that she wanted to sit, and she sewed her all her own clothing by hand with very tiny, fine stitches. She would go and she would buy a large bunch of material, and she would sew maybe three nighties that were all exactly the same out of a pattern she'd made up in her head. And she would take all the scraps and make something else out of it, never wasted anything. And we still eat a meal that we call Amparo's Combination, which was basically vegetables with raisins and eggs and things that we served over rice, which she ate every day, the very same thing. And it really made us so aware of the variety and things we have and how we take it for granted. We never think about it. We just go ahead and switch the lights on and go to the grocery store and buy all the different foods. And she taught us a lot.
Thank you. Who else? Testimonial time?
That's okay. I have a couple experiences of people from other parts of the world that I can think of that have an effect on my reactions to things that are happening in the world. The first of them was that when I was at the University of Minnesota 5-6 years ago, I, through the University International Student Center, arranged to have a friendship with an incoming Iranian student. And we hit it off very well that whole year and saw each other fairly regularly and would share our observations of his observations of American culture and mine, and he would share me with some of the things, observations he had from his own country. And after about a year after finishing with the university, I lost contact with him. But when we've had all this strife between the U.S. and Iran in recent years, I couldn't help but wonder, well, is Shardab Tabib, is he over there? Or is he still over here? And what is he thinking about all that's going on here? I certainly can't hate all Iranians, because this guy is a super fellow. And very sensitive to the political situation, and well, having known him before, I knew long before it hit the U.S. news media that there was a resistance to the Shah, and that there was violence going on in Tehran, and etc. The other experience that I have was that in 1974, I went to visit my brother who was in Peace Corps over in Afghanistan. And I spent 2 months over there, and most of the time I was fairly sheltered. I was spending the time with the other Peace Corps volunteers there, trying to learn how to speak Persian, though, so that I could communicate with the people there. Very few of the Afghans speak English well enough to be understood. And so now that the part of the country that I was in has been the center of much of the fighting that has happened since the Russian invasion. So I wonder whether the people that I knew over there, what has happened with them? Have they been killed? Are their towns destroyed? I have had no contact with anyone over there for many years now, and so I don't really know what has been happening there, but it does make it real to me, just as with Galina in Moscow, that this is affecting people that I know. And there were also things about the life there. The people were very poor, and so the way they had to conserve everything, things like we just take paper for granted. Paper, after it was used as a newspaper or for something else, would almost always end up being used to make bags for if you went to the store and got something. They didn't have special paper bags made for it. They would make all the bags themselves. Various other ways, thinking of conservation, which I had never thought of before, became so obvious to me after being in a place where people just could not take anything for granted.
I was just going to share I had a same experience with a young lady from Iran. I was able to work at a Girl Scout camp back in Connecticut, and they had an exchange. I wasn't a student, but they came over to work in Girl Scout camps and other kinds of camps in the United States. And the girl that I met was named Shamsi, and it was a delight to get to know her. She's the same age as what I was, and some of the things I learned from her is, even though she didn't have the same religion that I had, we both believed in the same God. I had Christ in that and she didn't, but basically we decided that we both had the same God. I also wondered, when the Iranian thing started, well, whatever happened to Shamsi? Was she still in the United States, or was she back in, she wasn't in Tehran, but she was in a town just outside of Tehran. Her brother was a dentist, and her father was a professor or something like that, you know, and just really ordinary people. And so when that conflict started, I could see both sides of the story of what was going on. Another experience I had is I lived for a while down in Davis, California, with the University of California, Davis there, and the young man I happened to be going with at the time was working on his master's degree in agricultural economics, and there were a lot of foreign exchange students working in that area, and I happened to go to a party that one of the professors was throwing, and as it turned out, my boyfriend and I were the only Americans there, and it was just a startling realization to me that you know, I knew there were other countries of the world and there were other people, but all of a sudden I was the minority, and all these other people from Africa and Ecuador and India and all over the place were just sitting around having a good time. And like I said, it was just a person-to-person kind of thing, that they're people just like us. And I think that's what I learned from both those experiences. So.
Thank you. I had the joy, or have the joy, of having a new friend from Zimbabwe. This fall, our American Lutheran Church women of the North Pacific District were involved in an exchange women-to-women program and brought over a lady from Zimbabwe, Africa, Anisia Mavua. A most remarkable lady is from a rural area where she and her husband and their 8 children live in a home which they built themselves from the bricks they made. She walks a mile to get the water she needs to take care of her family. And she is also unusual in that she has an education and is a school teacher, which is quite unusual. Most of the women cannot even read, the black women in Zimbabwe. But from this very poor, poor background, she also is a very active Lutheran woman over there and was brought over here. She didn't expect to be housed in our homes. She, from her background of what she'd seen between the whites and the blacks, had figured out that surely when she came over here, we would have trailers for her to live in, and then we would take her out and have her speak, and then she would be back in her little trailer again where she would cook her meal. She figured that out would be the only way it would happen. So she was overwhelmed when she found herself at our tables and in our homes and in our hearts. Her background over the past few years, you know that Zimbabwe was Rhodesia until just recently, and they've been gone through a revolution. So as her stories came out of the horrors of war, children kidnapped, I can't possibly tell you all Anisia stories right now. My life has been changed because of Anisia. Children kidnapped, gone for 5 years before she knew if they were alive, husband beaten, not knowing if he would live, all part of the horrors of war. And so here she comes, this marvelous Anisia, with this wonderful smile, this sense of humor, who tells these stories without being sorry for herself, that's what happened and that's the way it is, comes into our homes, which must have looked like palaces to her, was very interested in our dishwashers, wanted to know what a credit card was, wondered how we got our glasses so shiny, wondered how we cleaned those rugs, was very interested in how our church women had held our elections, quite interested that presidents of women's group were sometimes someone other than the minister's wife. She learned lots of interesting things while she was here and asked all kinds of questions. But being faced with all of this, which must have seemed like mansions, she wasn't a bit overwhelmed. She was interested. But she had her priorities straight, which really absolutely made me sit back and take notice. Her stories, for instance, of the women who are called the Vashandiri women. If you choose, the Lutheran women have a particular group who choose to dedicate themselves to God. Of course, they do things like hoe the garden and take care of the 8 children, and in her case, teach school and this long list, but they dedicate their lives to God. And they wear a uniform. And the reason they have chosen to wear this simple uniform, which is a skirt and a cape, is because some of the women in the church only have one dress. And she's fortunate enough to have 3. And the ones with only one feel kind of bad when the ones with 3 get to wear them. And those of us talking to Anicia and thinking of what's in our closets feel rather overwhelmed. But Anicia wasn't overwhelmed. She had things straight in her mind, and she knew what was glad, and she gave to us a great deal and learned a great deal from us. And Anicia has changed a great many lives in the North Pacific District because of being here.
Thank you. One more?
It's been some time ago. In 1964, my husband and I went to Venezuela to be volunteers for a group called Acción in Venezuela. The founder of that later became the head of the Peace Corps. His name was Joe Blatchford. But at the time, it was very important to him that Americans not go into a country with all their expensive equipment and all their college graduates and teach people in a condescending way how to do something that they would not know how to do after that American left. And so his plan was that the volunteers that he was leading would go there and teach Venezuelans how to do what we didn't know how to do, that we would find Venezuelans to teach us how to relate to their own people, and also that we would encourage Venezuelan businessmen to pay for the work that we did. So our project was in a little barrio. I never could learn to roll my R's after a year of Spanish. We rented a cement block house similar to the one in Cuernavaca for $6 a month from a man who had to ask his second wife to move so that he could make the money to rent it to us. We had a latrine that was almost to overflowing, and every time it rained, we were afraid it would. I could not carry water on my head, so we found 3 hoses and connected them to go to the end of the block. One of the projects that we had that was supported by the president of the cement company in Venezuela was to build a small infirmary. And it was a very painful thing for us to try to find Venezuelan people to support our project because they thought we were absolutely crazy to live in this little community. The women, I think, were braver in that way than the men. At least they were more affiliative with me. Also, I was very threatening to them that even though I lived in the same kind of house they did and ate similarly to them, I did have a stove that was given to me, even though the oven was uncontrollable. And I was cleaner. And I ate funny things sometimes, like cornflakes and peanut butter, which they had never seen before. But they were very kind to Fred and I, and used to invite us to dinner. As you mentioned, people with very little money would still host us in their little houses. Many of these women at 35 would look like some of you at 60. And that was always painful to me to see someone close to my, well, I was 28 then, but not that far away from my age with 9 children, a baby every year or less, looking very old. And their nutrition was extremely poor. The latrines often fed into the river, so the same river that they used to dump the latrines back into was the same water that the next village down was where the women took their clothes to wash. And then also the same river that they took the water to bring into their homes. So there were serious illnesses like Bilharzia. I can remember being horrified at Bilharzia, which I won't go into detail, but it slowly deteriorates the brain, and many people had to suffer watching a child die from something like that. And that we had no children and wouldn't have gone, I don't think, with a child into that area. But that, to me, is a sad thing, that fine women have no way to bring to their children what they themselves don't have. I also wanted to mention a word that when I was married, my husband was in the Navy in Korea, and so he thought it would be a great idea if I came to Korea and married him there. And I'm thinking of the strangers that I met that were women, that were really good to me. One was on the plane. I flew in the empty whole orphanage plane that left all the children in Portland and then went back empty so you could fly at a reduced rate. And there was a lovely Korean woman who was terribly homesick. She had gone to New York to visit her sister, who is a designer in Saks Fifth Avenue or something like that, but she didn't adjust like her sister, so she was going home on the Holt plane from Portland. And she befriended me in the hours it took to fly from Portland to Korea, and she introduced me to her fiancé, who was partly why she left Korea. She didn't know if she wanted to marry him or not. And she decided to, yes, she would marry him, introduced me to him, and he then helped us to plan a Korean-American wedding. And because of the two of them, we had tapered candles made in the marketplace. They had to make them five times. No one had ever had tapered candles from the local street market before. She came to the church the day of the wedding and arranged the flowers. She just did all these things for someone she barely knew. And other times in traveling, we have met prostitutes at early in the morning when we used to hitchhike in other countries, and they would show us where to stay because they knew where to stay. But they were always kind. And so, and then we met other people, sometimes men. We met a man at one point who insisted that he show us as a tourist where to go, and he would not leave us alone, and we were convinced that he wanted money, but what he wanted was to be a Christian witness in his country, and that was his hobby. And he was a principal of a school, but in his hobby he showed tourists all through his city. So that was an impressive thing to me too.
God so loved the world. I think we've been blessed by the sharing. I think we are blessed as we reach out and get to know people as individuals, whether it's in our travels or whether it's in our own community. Thank you for sharing. And let's keep learning about other people, because that's the politics of hope for the world through Christ.